Okay, so I'm going to start. My name is Ryan Fee, and I'm a painter. I've been a painter making different kinds of art for 40-something years, so I know I don't look that old, or do I? I'll just throw that compliment out at myself.
Started at three.
What I am not is a PhD in art history, and if anybody is really an expert and has something to contribute, I would love it. I would not be put off by that at all. So I'll say a lot of stuff, or even if you want to update or contradict something that I say, that's also very welcome. So anyway, here's how I'm going to start. Okay, so I don't know if you're familiar with this image or not. It was in the news a couple years ago at Art Basel Miami, where this artist, Maurizio Catalan, duct taped a banana to the wall. He sold it in an edition of three, called it The Comedian, and got $100,000 for two of them and $200,000 for the third. So this is kind of like today's version of the sort of pushback or hysteria that the general public receives when they think about art in the art world. And it's, you know, we live in a postmodern time, and this is, I don't know, a very postmodern work of art, meaning it's really busy breaking art down into pieces and components that we can then sort of discuss what really makes art or doesn't make art, and is it the market, and is it the concept of the artist, and all those kinds of issues, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that issue actually, in my mind, first came to the fore in like 1850-something with Manet making his Luncheon on the Grass, if you're familiar with that, or then again with Duchamp, and then again with pop art. So it's not a new topic, but anyway. I have a colleague named Brian Serra. Those are his initials. but it described him perfectly. And not to speak, he would say that, so I feel permitted to say that. He would say that himself. But he said this almost every day to his classes, and it drove me crazy, because it is the exact opposite of the truth. Like, no artist is trying to get away with anything. Well, I shouldn't say no. But artists are not trying to get away with something. They're trying to actually bring something, and including this artist. So he does get away with it, and it's kind of like a funny circle, because he's actually bringing something that asks what you can get away with. But he's not trying to get away with it. He's bringing something to talk about that question, which is different from trying to get away with something. Anyway, sorry. Let's try it that way. Let's go. Okay, so now I'm going back to cave art, believe it or not. I warned you yesterday that I was going to do this. So why do humans make art? And if you ask like 100 people, random people, I guess, nowadays, people will give you answers about creativity and beauty and imagination and expression, above all, expression. So that is a very new phenomenon in human history. The reason why artists make art is because they need to make art, that it has a function in the world. And that is why I wish I had a whiteboard. Oh, I do. What a coincidence. So I'm going to do my quick whiteboard demonstration. Here it is. This is the year that Christ was born, so we'll call it zero, even though it was near zero. This is the year 1000, you know, like the first millennium, the end of the Middle Ages, let's say. Here's the year 2000. So we're like right about here on this timeline. So if I go back 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40,000 years, that's that image. So we look here, we're like, oh, let's go back and study the Renaissance. That's here. You know, let's go back to study early Roman art. That's here. Greek art here. Jesus here. Right? So all the huge waves of time that we think of when we think of history are all in this little one inch. And now I'm like, well, this is only the oldest work of art that we know about, so when I was in school, it was here at 30,000. It was the Venus of Willendorf. Now it's, you know, they keep going further back, and there's some in Australia in Aboriginal art, and there's some in, this one's in Indonesia. But what's cool about it is they all have kind of a similar function. And what I mean by function is we look at this with our eyes and we're like, oh, it's telling the story of life hunting. You know, and it's like, if you think about that for a second, it makes no sense. It's really very absurd because, for one thing, they need to survive, and they're not busy decorating, and they're not busy, like, telling stories. They're busy surviving, number one. Number two, these things are always found in, like, the most remote, dark, forbidden, inaccessible part of the cave. If I was going to be in a cave, the only light source is the mouth of the cave, and so I would go right by the mouth of the cave where there's lots of light, people can enjoy my artwork. And I would tell the story of the hunt. But that's not what they did. In fact, at Altamira, paleontologists had been in that cave many, many, many times, and they never saw the drawings until, this is a legend, by the way, it might not be it, but it's a great story. One of the paleontologist's daughters was with him, and they're all crouching, because the ceiling's only this high, and it's way inside the mountain. And they're crouching with their flashlights, and they're looking for like little bits of whatever they're finding. And the daughter's like, look, bulls and bisons and hunters all over the ceiling that grown-ups could not see because they were not, you know, laying on their backs. So the idea that it's something to just tell a story or to recount the hunt or any of those things just doesn't make any sense. What does make sense is you go to your most sacred, private place and you enact a ritual that's going to bring you good fortune on the next hunt, because without that good fortune, you will not survive. And so that's what happens in 44,000. And across time, because those cave paintings went on for 10, 20, 20, 30,000 years, and then you have another kind of survival. This is one sculpture that's being seen from three views called Venus of Willendorf. It's about this big. And again, there's no metal tools. Taking the time when you should be hunting or like fighting animals or building better protection for your wherever you live, whatever it is, taking time to make this sculpture, particularly the head, which is like, whoa, what a lazy cop-out. But it isn't a lazy cop-out. Like, there's a pattern there. Pattern is something that is one of the weirdest things that humans do, which makes no sense. There's no explanation for pattern. It serves no purpose. But we're in love with it. We can't do things without pattern. We can just cover things with pattern. And so this is carving pattern in rock with other rock. So the idea that this thing had like some special purpose, and a lot of ancient art where people think, oh, they didn't know how to draw in those days, is really like, well, actually, the power of something is lost the more realistic it is. For example, in a pharaoh's tomb, you have a sculpture of the pharaoh looking highly idealized, like no human ever looked, like some weird robot. But the pharaoh's advisor has a pot belly and like sagging flesh. So they did make the person realistic when it wasn't an important person, but when it's a god or a ruler, they make them less realistic because it gives them power. And so this particular power is fertility. So it has a big belly, it has a vagina that's very clearly marked for conception, it has huge breasts, the legs and feet kind of disappear, or maybe they broke off, but the arms, you can see the arms going across the breast, they're like these little teeny little twigs. And then the face, of course, is just gone, because if we give it a face, it loses that power. Now, I want to go on a little side, quick note, which is everything I'm saying sounds so good and sounds so right, but of course, it's just our best guess, right? We don't have any history. I just want to say that, because I think when people like act like they really know what they're talking about. So anyway, this is happening also back in 40,000 BC, made out of a horn from a reindeer. And the first fired clay was also a fertility symbol. And so across time, across time, across time, we need to keep reproducing. Babies die. I know that my grandfather was one of 27 children. And 11 lived to adulthood. So that's why they had 27 children, because even that was only my grandfather. That was like 120 years ago that his mother was worried to continue the family, we just have to keep making more and more children. So think about that. That was a pretty modern era. Now we're back. Anyway, sorry, I'm going on so many digressions, I'm going to really fall behind. Again, so another purpose. And it's kind of like the same purpose, which I just said, which is it's survival. You need that ritual to happen to have babies. You need that ritual to happen to have food. But you also just need the ritual to happen because religion gives you your meaning in life. It's maybe the most important thing there is. And so here's the first, one of the first versions of a god. And again, you don't want it to be realistic. So how do you make gods? You combine animals together, or you combine animals and people together to create a mythical creature, a mythological creature. So that's happening, and it goes across time. And I would love to show you a million examples, but I'm keep going. One of the most famous things, probably everybody in the world knows this one because it's either in your history class or your art history class, the idea that a ruler is getting the law from a god on a surface that's impossibly hard, this diorite with the law all etched into it. You know, it just has so much purpose. It's not meant to, it looks great. It's actually really amazing to look at, but it's not doing anything except for work for us. It's establishing who the power is and where he got his power and what to do with that power. Okay? You know, in Egypt, you see, it's like, what you really need is 4 40-foot statues of yourself, side by side. This is not like him and his brothers. Okay, so there's a temple carved inside this mountain. It's just extreme, and again, it's like, it's really establishing the power, as we all know, but people know the history of Egypt really well, so I'll just kind of just keep going. You know, we're now in Rome, and now we're like looking at pretty lifelike images, and so you think about it for a second. The two gestures that he's making are highly symbolic of his authority and his power over the crowd, and then the proportion of him to his horse is kind of absurd. I mean, it's a strong horse, but then he's like way too big for it. Like he's in front of the supermarket and he doesn't want anybody to see that they put a quarter in the machine or something. Okay. So now we're looking at, you know, 7000 BC and the first time people start making civilization and cities. And so that happens, but then immediately at the exact same moment, you're getting towers and castles and walls that are about power and about the whatever gods you're serving and about who has the fortress either for protection or some kind of exhibition of power. So, you know, maybe the greatest building ever made, the Parthenon, is an extreme example of that. Again, it seems like so long ago. If you think about my timeline, it's a minute ago, but it's amazing. And then you go around the world and it's happening in Mayan culture and it's happening in Buddhist Hindu culture and it's happening, you know, where they just do these spectacular things. And this is my favorite period of art history, just because the Romans had the technology of concrete, but these Middle Ages artists didn't. So they just stacked things really well. That's really all there is. Just a bunch of stone stacked up and carved really perfectly, and the engineers figuring out perfectly. So again, like even now we're getting into, you know, the year 1200, which is like a minute ago on my timeline, just a hair away, you know, it's still things are being done. If you try to find the name of an engineer or an architect of any great Gothic cathedral in Europe, you will not be able to. Or anything that I've showed you so far. For a tiny window in ancient Greece, they recorded the names of a few artists and architects, and then that kind of went away. But for all the rest of human history, it didn't matter. It wasn't about the artist. It was about, you know, what this work did. The person who designed this knew it was going to be 150 years before it was done, and that they weren't going to see it, and their son wasn't going to see it. You know, they just knew it needed to be made, and they needed to, like, do their part. Okay, so that is art functioning and working and functioning and working and doing work for us. And now it's, like, a little bit of a turning point. This is a very famous comparison. If you ever took art history class, this might be, like, something that you've seen before. Two artists that we know their names, Cimabue and Giotto. So Cimabue, like taking classic medieval symbolic style with the gold round, and I could go on, it's way too long, it's fun to talk about, but I'm behind again. So I'll just say this. He's sort of seen as a kind of lifelike person compared to most medieval art, but then you look at Giotto and they're like, he like blew the world open. Like the fact that you could see breasts under her shirt, for example, or knee under her robe. Just the three-dimensional quality of the entire thing, that light is coming from one side, which is the way that we do observe the world, just wasn't done by artists because, again, it was always symbolic and it was always doing a purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, this is still an altarpiece. It's still doing a purpose. But now we know the artist's name, and now it's starting to be a little lifelike. And then we go into the full Renaissance. Oh. Yeah. So We got the four great Italian Renaissance artists, Michelangelo, Leonardo, Donatello, and Raphael. And again, think of this, a children's comic and cartoon. Those artists were so famous that now, like 500 something years later, they're like in our regular vocabulary. So all of a sudden we're in a world that had never happened before, of stars, right? Of like the rock stars. If Michael Jackson's name is known in 500 years, props to Michael Jackson, right? That's like, so now we're, you know, in the high Renaissance, and this is in the north, and this is Jan van Eyck. And it's like the ultimate, like I wish you could walk up to this real painting because the velvetiness and the metal and the jewels and the gold and the anatomy and the landscape and the blood of Christ coming out of the Lamb, you know, it's just so incredibly beautifully rendered, and his name is of course on the picture. And so we're now getting to this place where naturalistic starts to take over the symbolic function, and yet it's still doing work, it's still in the church, it's still telling us our theology. And then we get this. This one is not doing work. This is a self-portrait of the artist. Now, we think that it's normal for an artist to make a self-portrait, but this is like one of the first ones ever known. Like, the Renaissance artists did do self-portraits, and so he's one of them. He's not the only one. But that idea is kind of like a big step towards modernism. It's a big step to the world that we live in now. Because they're like, oh, I don't have to make it about gods or rulers or the law or the religion or to keep off bad spirits or anything. I'm just going to show you what I look like. I'm worth doing. Okay, so what is modern? Okay, at the end of the Renaissance, you have the Baroque era and the different kinds of, but basically it leads into an era around the time of the Enlightenment. So we're say the 1700s. Which was the era of Romanticism, and people hear that word, they think it means like love and romance, but it doesn't mean that, it means all those words. The first time humans believed, I don't know if you ever studied your philosophy, but the first time the humans believed that everybody has their freedom, right? The Bill of the Declaration of Independence, it's like your inalienable right to have your freedom and your feelings and your expression. That's a thing that belonged only to an upper class in human history until now. And so that's really setting the table. And so artists are showing pictures that are full of passion and energy and, you know, expression like crazy. And they're really not doing as much. I mean, they're serving certain kinds of needs, but really quite different from everything I've shown you so far. They're starting to head into a modern thing, but I'll talk about that when I get a little further along. You know, there's just like, it's just like huge amounts of drama, huge amounts of feeling. Okay, so that's what Romanticism was about. When we turn over into the 19th century, the beginning of the 1800s, you start to, well, more like the middle of that century, things that we think are normal, that had never happened, which is this. You know, I was discussing with this guy Bruce this morning about breakfast cereals. It's like, you know, every time there's like a new version of Cocoa Krispies, it's not new, they just put new on it. I don't know why, they just keep putting new on it. Why? Because we'll buy it. Like, we value new, but human history did not value new. They valued tradition and doing it the right way and following the established way that had been built up over time. Okay, so that's a modern idea. I just said it, newness and breaking from the past are basically the same thing. Individual expression, I just mentioned, talking about the Romanticism. So now, art for contemplation, okay, that is what we think art is. It's like, let's go to a gallery and look at art and think about it and talk about it and let it work its work on us. Let's go to a museum. Let's go to a slideshow. Okay, like an artist, we don't ever expect art to do work for us anymore, except for this role, which is work. It's just a different kind of work. It's like a inner, maybe contemplative, philosophical, spiritual, psychological work. Okay, so, but that's kind of like taking away that idea. I remember the distinction being made very clearly for me as a high school student who was trying to, had guidance counselors, right? And they're like, you can do fine art, which is kind of a waste of time, or you can do applied art, which is like putting art to work, you know, designing something, right? So that's, you know, there really is a distinction now in our culture that did not exist before. And then this idea that being cultured, like I want to know about stuff, I want to, it's not just for the Duke and the mayor and the governor and all the powerful people, but it's for me. I could be educated and I can know, you know, that Raphael was a better artist than Michelangelo and that, you know, Donatello was a whatever, blah, blah, blah. So all of those things are now coming into the whole human way of experiencing the world. And we come out of that. Again, look at the timeline. We're just a second away from that. So we are born into that. Here's what makes modern art modern. Number one, you are fixated on your place in that timeline. You know exactly what just happened, and you know you're trying to figure out what should happen next. That's what artists are busy doing. I went to art school in the 1980s, and we all were like nervous, like, what, you know, still modernism was just kind of ending at that time. And we didn't know it was ending. We're like, what's gonna come next? You know, and I'm gonna show you this really fast bunch of slides in a second. And when we get to like around 1980, you're gonna agree with me. You're gonna be like, you should have been nervous because there's nothing left to do. Okay? So they wanna capture their age, their exact age. And then they want to try to anticipate the next thing. And then this thing is the main thing, okay? If you want to know what modern art is, and if you want to like have a toehold to get in there, instead of being like, oh, that thing is a mess, I can't understand it, just be like, okay, modern art has one goal, and that is to talk about itself. To talk about the artist and the artist's style and what the art is doing. It's not of anything anymore, it is something. Not a picture of this, it is the picture. So how the paint and the lines and the composition and all those other parts act on that surface is what modern art is about. And so nobody sits there and goes, what could I do next randomly? Or what could I get away with, like I showed you that first slide. Instead, they're like, what could I do that needs to be done next? To continue this conversation that's like driving forward like a freight train out of control. So, So here's mid 1800s. So Courbet is famous for saying, I'm never gonna paint like an angel because I've never seen one. He's like, I'm not gonna paint like gods and flying horses, you know, I'm not gonna paint like giant war scenes from the Trojan War, because that doesn't happen. This is what happens. I go to work and I see these two guys, this old guy and his son, breaking stones into gravel. Very appropriate for this mining town. And, you know, that's poverty and that's real life. That's something I can paint. And then a little while goes by and you have Monet. Monet was hated, of course, at his time because he was painting like in this way that drew attention to his style. Like, of course, you can see it's the train station. You can see people. It looks like a piece of normal modern life. But sorry about that. This thing is like a little. And yet, he's like, okay, I'm going to do what Courbet did. I'm going to show you like regular life. I'm going to show you the industrial age coming around us. It's all about my time. But I'm also going to break it down into this optical effect. When I receive the world, I receive it as a quick, scientific sensation on my eyes that I can best put down by just breaking it into all its little parts so that you can't really decipher it as this clear thing, but more as like an impression, like a fast, fleeting moment. And that feels very modern too. So now it's in our dentist office wall, every dentist office, but at that time it was totally scandalous. And a little while later, you get Cezanne, who goes a little further, and he's like, now I'm gonna just take colors, the greens that are in the landscape, and I'm going to put them in the sky, and the oranges that are in the landscape, and put them in the mountain. I'm going to kind of like, I'm going to let my picture start telling me what to do instead of the other way around. And I'm going to like start breaking things down and building things. I still want it to look like solid form, but I want it to like come apart and go back together in a way that is most balanced and pleasing to my picture, not to how it really looks. So he's really obedient to what he needs to do, but we look at it, we're like, that bottle's a little off. Why is it leaning or something like that? Okay, so he's doing what artists really, a modern artist does, which is let the picture take control. So now, why is this? Because those things we can handle. I can handle that. It's modern, even more modern. And then it's like, well, what is this stuff? This looks like something somebody got away with. Okay, so now, here's why. I'm gonna just there. I could take this. I could do this little game right here on like 10 different avenues. And I'm just gonna pick one, and it's called expression. So if we go back to that picture that I showed you by Jan van Eyck, which I'm gonna do, and we say which artwork compared to that is more expressive, his or the next person? His is not that expressive. It's expressive because it shows his mood and it shows him, like I said, not a god. But then you look a little while later, less than a century later, you got El Greco and the Mannerists, Tintoretto, and they're like, you know, like the fashion model proportions. Everything's stretched out long for more drama, and the shadows look like a flashbulb went up, and there's black and there's white, and so it's all very theatrical. And of course, El Greco is way more dramatic. And then the Baroque time comes, and you have Rubens, and it's just like even more, like his brushstrokes are like wild, wild, wild. And you know, the color is heightened up, and the expression is almost like cartoonishly exaggerated. You're like, okay, it's more expressive. And then you look at it next to Berthe Morisot, an impressionist, or any impressionist. It's like, okay, that's not more exciting than the war scene, seeing a woman sitting there. But if you look at how she painted it, it's incredible. It's such an incredible painting, because it almost looks like she just like accidentally smeared it a little bit, and it comes out looking so well. So the idea that, again, like I said with Monet a minute ago, the idea that you can have this fleeting moment where it's just put down in this quick, quick, quick way, you know, in a way it does feel more expressive, because it's like you're just kind of like, it's just gestures and spontaneous actions, and it's not like a careful study of the human anatomy now. It's just that, so it becomes more expressive even than that. Until we look at the famous Vincent van Gogh, where, you know, there's no way he would ever paint like a flat sea or a flat sky, as you all know. Everything he ever painted was like swirling, messy chaos. And so he's more expressive, and also he keyed the color way, way up. Until you compared him to Munch, where now the figure is distorted and the color's really distorted and the background is distorted, and everything is just contributing to that one expressive idea of some kind of pain in the cry or in the scream. Until you compare him to German expressionists in the early 20th century, like Emil Nolde or Kirchner, who like really exaggerated things and really used a lot of black and big fat strokes of paint so that it was like a punch in your face instead of this little like, you know, vibration. Until you got to post-war and there's Francis Bacon. He's like painting religious figures and political figures in this way that makes them look like demons, and there's slabs of meat with their ribs exposed, and there's blood, and there's garish colors. And then till you compare him to Kooning, who doesn't care about the woman at all. It's called Woman, that's the name of the painting. But it's like, I just need something to look at so I can do my thing with the kind of energy that I have as an expressive artist. Like basically, the abstract expressionists in the 1950s in New York are like all painting about how mythical they are. Like, I am an artist of great power and great, so I'm gonna just prove it by doing everything with this exaggerated gesture. Until you get Franz Kline, it's like, oh, some people are like, that's a person sitting on a chair, and some people are like, oh no, that's the top of someone's head, and it's like, well, not really, it doesn't matter. He's painting now with like a brush the size of a broom, a kitchen broom, and he's just dipping in black, and he's like, smash, smash through this thing, get rid of color, get rid of like little dabbling. Until you compare him to Pollock, who was the most offensive artist of the last century, and yet he was a surrealist who could paint really well, studied under one of those great American regionalists, but I can't think of his name right now at this second. But you know, he was very well trained. He wasn't like some guy who just like made a splashy mess and said, I wonder if I could sell it to somebody. He really took a long time to get to the stage, and he had a lot of angst about it. But my point is that he now is like, I'm gonna organize my picture. I'm gonna let my picture tell me what to do, like Cézanne. But I'm also going to put it down with the gesture of de Kooning, but I'm also going to let it fall off my brush and have its own life where it has even more energy. And all those things are happening at once. So he's sort of like he's kind of like almost like the climax of modern art, except, sorry, that's him in action. I wish I had time. How's my time?
You're going to have power.
Well, good. I will tell you the story. In LA last year, I went to the MoCA, Museum of Contemporary Art. And you know, they always have, every museum has restorers on their staff that are always taking care of the work. And they had begun this big restoration project on a Pollock that they own. And it's comical. I mean, think about it. If, like, he's walking in it. He's smoking and he's dropping his cigarette ashes in it. His footprints are in it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so it looks like this. And you're like, let's restore it. You know, like with Rembrandt, I get it. Right? There's like the oil starts to darken and you want to see the skin tones again. So you carefully remove that outer layer of varnish, you know. But it's like, really? And they had a string. They had a string. They put a string like from here to here. You know why? Because they wanted to be able to tell where they had worked on so far. So they would move the string down like an inch so they could work on that inch. And it was like a comical, unintentionally comical art performance piece.
There's a story, I don't know if it's this Pollock restoration, but apparently someone tried to fix a Pollock that got ripped. And so when they were restoring it, that's when they noticed it. Because you couldn't notice it. Somebody kind of faked a pouring paint on it, and they could tell by the paint, you know, like the kind of alkaloid, it wasn't the type of paint that Pollock would have used. So they realized that somebody faked this restoration.
Anyway, if you go to the art museum and you go to the modern section, or you go to a modern art museum, and you get a chance to like walk up to the Klein or walk up to the Pollock, I recommend it. They're great paintings. I love them. They're not getting away with anything. They are trying to find the truth, and each one of these artists is like, the truth is a little bit finer than what you discovered. You're right, and you were more right than the person before you, but I want to be even more right by getting really to the essence of what it's all about. And they always did these things at huge scale, so you could like get swallowed up in them. And a Pollock in person is really an amazing thing. Anyway, Kazuo Shiraga in Japan does a Pollock in mud by laying in it, which is a little more truthful and a little more honest, because instead of like saying, oh, at the end of my activity, my painting is a record of my activity, Pollock might say. Probably wouldn't, but you could say that about him. Here's like, I'm just going to do the activity. And then when the rain comes and washes it away, that's fine. But it's the performance anyway. It's the idea that the artist's gesture is what the work is about. So I'm just going to do the gesture. And so there's a whole school of artists that are doing that. Then you come to one of my favorite artists. Being from Queens, New York, and this is a woman from Queens, New York, Meryl Laterman Michaelis. In 1976, she makes a work of art, and all those Polaroids are people from the day shift that work in this big building, and from the night shift that work in this building. And she walks up to all the workers and she says, would you give up one of your 8 hours and not call it work, but instead call it art performance? And they're like, okay, this lady's crazy. But they did, and she recorded it. And she's like, if Pollock's masculine, exciting gesture, or Shiraga rolling in the mud to show like the gesture of the power of art making, if a gesture can be art, if the idea can be art, then can't any human activity be named as art? And can't we actually like redeem something that is more noble than rolling in the mud, or your show-offiness of being a big, you know? So there's something really beautiful about this idea. And again, she's not getting away with something. She's actually taking it to the next step in a really beautiful, profound way. And here's another artist. I want to pronounce his name correctly, and I was practicing because I always say it wrong. It's Derching Zhe. And he did 5 years of one-year art projects. So in this project, he put his time card in this time slot and took a picture of himself every hour for a year. Every hour. I don't mean day hours. Oh my God. Every hour for a year. And you can go to the museum and you can see all these Polaroids, thousands of them. And then they photographed them and made like a stop motion movie. And you can see his beard growing and his hair growing. When they play them, it takes like 6 minutes to see them all if there's like 30 frames a second. And he's basically saying, my activity and even the rigorousness of it and even the pain of it is going to be what my art is about, like the suffering artist maybe. The next year, the year before this, he put himself in a cage for a year, a wooden cage, not allowed to leave, not allowed to speak to anybody. Just had a friend come and take his excrement away and give him food. But he couldn't even talk to that guy for a year. And then he does this for a year, and then you know the next year after that, he tethered himself to another human being. His fourth year, he lived on the street. He's like, I'm not going to go inside for a year. And he documented every single day, just very carefully, because it was an art performance piece. I think his fifth year was, my favorite one in a way is funny, because it was to not talk about art in any way. Not to look at art, not to go to a museum or gallery, not to mention art.
How do you document that?
I don't know. Ask his friends, right? They all got to sign a paper. He actually had lawyers signing these things to make sure that it was all. So why am I showing this? Because simultaneously you have artists who are responding in a different way in what has been like badly named minimalism, but let's just use that word for a second and just say that you can still say that the canvas itself is the boss, and you can still say that it's about this surface and paint on that surface. Pick your favorite painting of all time. Pick the most realistic painting of all time that shows that deep space. Take your most, you know, incredible expressive painting. All of them have one thing in common. They're a two-dimensional surface with a bunch of colors put on it. And so Rothko's like, well, instead of putting it in that big, messy way, can't I put it in like a more poetic, sensitive, carefully thought-out way with color relationships and space and shimmering edges? And then you have Newman, who this painting is so huge, and so you're blinded by this incredible force of red, but then it's interrupted by what he called these zips, which are symbols for artistic inspiration. And then you have Kelly, who looks outside and maybe he sees like a field and a lake and a barn, and he's like, okay, a field and a lake and a barn, when I draw them realistically on a canvas, are flat pieces of color. So why don't I just break it down to what it really is and just tell the truth? And Frank Stella's like, well, if I really want to talk about how it's a structure, why don't I take the rectangle away? Because when we see a rectangle, we don't think about the shape at all, because that seems normal. But as soon as I make it its own shape, then you're going to be like, oh yeah, painting really is an object, isn't it? And if I take the content of my paint, which is taking black paint and leaving the whiteness of the canvas showing, and I let the content of the painting exactly mimic the edges, that's going to draw even more attention to it, and it's going to prove that a painting is nothing but paint on a surface, and that it's an object that you can take off the wall, put under your arm, and take home. It's never going to be a window into another world. Or Richard Serra, like, okay, it doesn't even need to be painted on canvas. It could be a 3-ton piece of Corten steel balanced on another piece of 2-ton Corten steel, and the painting on it is just the natural rusting that happens. So I'm done pretty much. When I went through that little stream, it was really, generalizations on top of generalizations, just to save time. Something that could take months and months and months to talk about, I've been doing like 10 minutes, so, but I could go down this path, and I could go down this path, and I could go down this path, and this one. I love that one. And I could go down, that one's really great. The Dada and Surrealism one is just like fantastically funny and smart, and the De Stijl one is another one of those like super simplified minimal things, and regionalism is like a certain time of American history, and you know, minimalism I talked about a little bit, performance art I talked about a little bit, pop art is a new version of Dadaism, conceptual art is I talked about a little bit. Op art is like these crazy designs that play games with your eyes. Super realism, another version of that. Social practice art, new expressionism, street art, etc. And this is like, sorry, this is just like a, you know, I could actually double or triple or quadruple this list if I really wanted to be an art historian about it. This is all in the last 100 years. So this idea, it's kind of great if you think about it. Like all those other periods are great for the reasons that I said. But the fact that people are gonna just like go so full bore and belief, like they believe in the power of art and what art, you know, art is like a voice calling them and telling them to do something. And they're kind of being obedient to it and they're believing it, you know? And so now we live in a time, like I said, like modernism in American art world, in art, in general, in the art world, kind of ended around the 60s, 70s. And we entered a time of postmodernism where everything's more deconstructed and it's more like you're making stuff where the idea is the main thing. And that feels a little empty to me. It feels a little sad to me, especially at the end of that exciting story. But on the other hand, I'm in the Broad Museum in Los Angeles, and there's a Mark Bradford that's like 35 feet long, and it's made by taking wads of colored paper and gluing them to the surface and then putting more and more and more and more and then taking a sander and sanding away the layers And so that's what that painting is. Sanding away all the colored layers that are hidden underneath the top layers. And it's just so beautiful. It makes you just happy. Okay, and it's very modern. But Mark Bradford is born in a postmodern time, and he knows that what he has to deal with as far as entering the dialogue. He has to talk about, you know, what it means compared to all the modern work and all the work that came before it, and what art's function in society is, and how we can break it down, and what him being African American has to do with it. And with his mother collecting papers, barely able to feed him. What was the reason why she had papers? A beauty shop, right?
When you do a permanent perm.
Or this guy, I'm showing you like my like five most favorite contemporary artists, just because I want to end on a note of hope. Okay, so it's like this guy, Thomas Noskowski, he just died a couple years ago. I bumped into him in a gallery where his work was showing, and I was like, you know, like starstruck, you know, and he's like a guy not much older than me. And he's just like a child when he paints, the kind of discovery and play and beauty that he just comes up with. I don't know how he does it, but it's a very modern idea, like Bradford. This is also like as big as this room. Julie Maritu, African-American woman, highly conceptualized artwork that begins with a bunch of photographs of places and news events, and then she takes that visually and starts to like break it down into all of its parts, and then she does something that you're not supposed to do in the postmodern world, which follows her
intuition.
And you know how I know that? Because no art historian would ever write that, because it sounds so old-fashioned, it sounds so modern, that seems naive. But I saw her in an interview, and she kept using the word intuition, and all the Los Angeles people in their skinny little suits and weird haircuts are like, oh, intuition. And I'm like, no, intuition, that's awesome, you know? It's like, she's just like proud of it, because come on, that's never gonna go out of art. Art is always gonna be the artwork telling you what to do. So, this guy Leonardo drew, so great, like just wood scraps peeling away. This looks also pretty appropriate for Holden Village. Bryce Marden, maybe one of my favorite artists of all time, just keeps doing, he's been doing this since the 60s, I think, or 70s. And he just keeps finding new ways to take this vocabulary of a tangle of lines and just making some kind of beautiful arrangement of it. And what that means is that 100 years or 200 years from now, somebody's still going to be making paintings like this, because those things are not exhausted. The nice thing about the postmodern way of deconstructing everything is not that it ended it, but that it made it available. It opened it up. Oh, anybody can do that. I don't have to like be the person in the timeline saying, this is what happened, what's next. I could be like, oh, 300 years ago, that was cool. Oh, and 50 years ago, that was cool. I'm gonna take those two things and see, do what nobody else ever did, because the picture's telling me that's a good idea. So that's like very hopeful. Like for me, postmodernism, people are always nervous about it. And I'm like, no, I think it's the opposite. I always saw it as something very hopeful. So anyway, that's the end of my thing.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, I wanna hear questions.
Oops.
And I wanna,
I don't know if I'm supposed to
keep this on when I'm asking questions.
Do the titles of these modern works provide a description of what the artist is seeing or portraying?
Sorry. This is a weird image to have up on the screen. I'm going to take it off. Maybe I'm not. I apologize. I don't know how to get rid of it. Okay, we're just going to look at it. That answer is true at all times, not just modern art, and the answer is the same answer across all times, which is sometimes. You know what I mean? Like sometimes they'll be really specific with the titles, and the titles have a lot to do with it, and sometimes they put text in it, which is great. I love that. Like text in art is a very modern thing and a very postmodern thing, where you're actually allowed to like fill it with words to sort of generate, you know, maybe not tell you exactly what it's about, but if you throw a couple of words in there and you cross them out and then you like write other words on top of them and then the title now is giving you information, you know, it's a funny thing that people go to museums and they walk from like, they read this for 5 minutes, they look at the picture, and then they go to the next one. And they read this for 10 minutes, like, oh yeah. So it's like, We're such a text-driven culture that we want to know the answer. It's like, oh, the answer, you know. But yeah, so that's a really good question, because the meaning is partly derived from, definitely from those kinds of things. Absolutely. Other question? Yes.
I want to go home and do the duct tape banana, but it's going to stink after a couple of days.
Well, when you buy a work of art like this, there's an artist named Saul LeWitt who does wall drawings, and they're kind of geometric in a way. They're kind of beautiful. They mostly end up looking like patterns. The Mass MoCA, which is a huge factory area in Massachusetts that became a contemporary art space, has like a gymnasium-sized walls covered with these Saul LeWitts, right? But he never made any of them. He just wrote instructions. And so what happens is the people that actually buy it and then enact it, or have somebody come and enact it for them, have to interpret what he meant. And so every time it's done, it's a little different. You know, and like a child might take those instructions and it might come a little different. And so there's something cool about that conceptual art. There's an artist named Alana Tsui, an African artist, who has like the whole village come together and gather those metal caps on top of liquor bottles. You know, the little thing that goes around the shoulder, and they open them up and they flatten them down and they sew them together like a patchwork quilt. Except it looks like jewels. It looks so beautiful. But every time that those pieces are hung, his instructions are hang it however you want. So sometimes they hang it like a curtain, sometimes they hang it like folds of drapery, you know, and it really has a really different feeling depending on what space they put it in, how the curator decides to put it. So that's kind of cool that option is available. And Catalan, by the way, who made the banana, would love it if you would do that. But when he sells the work, he's like, tape a banana to the wall. Like, you don't even have to take his piece of duct tape or his banana. You just, you know, oh, we got guests coming over, we're going to buy some bananas so that we can exhibit our Catalan. Oh, we're out of duct tape. Don't use moving tape. That totally destroys the idea. Sorry.
So how are the digital artists that where it goes away, how are they adding to the conversation about the ephemeral nature of art and what you're doing about that? Well, like Bill Gates put a lot of money into that.
Yes. I'm trying to think of the...
The NP of the...
Thank you. The non... Fungible
token.
Yes. Thank you. NFTs. So now you can buy like a digital idea that doesn't ever exist and never will. A digital version of an artwork, but you own it. You know, I should have kept it on that Chinese artist She who put the time card every hour. That was a page from Sotheby's, the auction house, and it says who it sold to. So somebody owns that piece, even though it took place back in the 70s. Somebody owns that. So that's kind of like the answer. Like it's people understand that that the Venus of Willendorf in 30,000 BC, that fat fertility symbol, is not about the rock or the woman, it's about the idea. And every work of art ever since has always been about the idea anyway. So if we could just hold on to the idea and own the idea, that's kind of cool. Like we're in an age now where that's become so familiar that it doesn't offend us. But that's a pretty new thing that it doesn't offend us.
It's not that new. I mean, like if I publish an essay in a journal, I have to pay for the rights. Not only I have to find the artist, find their family, get the permission of that artist to use that picture in my article, and then I have to pay an actual company's digital image of that. And so in a way, it's just if I own that, then I don't have to go through all that anymore. So it's not something new. It's now
in the visual art world.
Now it's being expressed as an artwork. Yes. But in reality, that's how it functions day in and day out.
And there was a question over on this side.
I was just going to say that the banana and the duct tape, I work at a high school, a junior high and high school, and we did that. We just did that. And it just spurred so much conversation. So in some ways, it made something really accessible, and we had a lot of conversation. Because it was so replicable.
Yes, yes. And honestly, like that genre, there was a time in the 90s where they had a genre of art called appropriation, where like there would be a great photographer, Walker Evans, and his photograph would be on the wall. He took these pictures during the Depression. And then this artist, Sherry Levine, would take pictures of his pictures and put it on the wall. And it's like, well, she did the same thing that he did, which is take a picture of something that he didn't own the families that he took pictures of. Just like she doesn't own the wall with a picture, he's just taking a picture. So who owns that originality and beginning that conversation about what originality really means and is anything really original? Like, that's worth making art about. So even though at first you're looking at that, you're like, that's kind of cheating. That's kind of like a cheap way to get away with making art, but then not really, because it has so many layers underneath. So that idea that Catalan has a toilet as a work of art, and if you know any modern art history, you know Marcel Duchamp did that in 1919, where he took a toilet, a men's urinal, put a fake signature on it, Armut, put it on a table, called it a sculpture, and named it The Fountain. And he was basically trying to bring a conversation about what beauty was and what art was. But now Maurice Catalan takes that same thing and casts it in gold, literally cast in gold. And it's like you can go into the bathroom at the Guggenheim Museum and go to the bathroom in it, because they hooked up the plumbing. And then they actually, some collector bought it in England and it got stolen from his house. And they probably melted it because it was a lot of gold. But again, like those ideas of keep reproducing and keep repeating these experiments that artists do that enliven the conversation about art means that conversation is never going to end. So I love that idea.
And a banana and duct tape are things that you can just find around.
Yep. And it's like you're going to be like, I'm going to be like progressive and like do an eggplant or. Yes, question.
It almost sounds like it relies on marketing. I mean, I read somewhere somebody sold an invisible sculpture to somebody, I forget what it was. And then there's also, I don't remember what, I haven't read much about recently, but there's an art display of X amount of pounds of candy in a corner.
Right.
And I can't remember what it represents.
That's
Felix
Gonzalez
Torres.
I'll actually show him.
You can actually take the candy and eat it.
You can take the candy.
And
it seems to me like if you're bright enough and intelligent enough, you almost don't even have to be an artist. I mean, you could just market that kind of thing, which is scary. Because you can also be a scam artist and say, here's what you're doing.
You're right.
Also,
the
Felix Gonzalez Torres is actually an act of grace. You get something for free and he's giving it to you.
He has like lots of narratives behind his work that has to do with different kinds of suffering that he's gone through and things like that, and different kinds of grace that he's received. So that's part of it. But what you just said, if you're smart enough and bright enough to do this, you could do it without being an artist, but that kind of is like the definition of being an artist, really. That makes you an artist. So it's kind of like, oh, if you're smart enough and bright enough, you are an artist. You know? Maybe, like, anybody can learn to paint a tree realistically, and if that helps you take your smartness and brightness and translate it onto something that can inform the world, your way of seeing the world, that's awesome. But if you can do it without learning how to paint a tree, that's also awesome. They're not that far apart from each other. And there are artists, by the way, who are forgers, and there's artists who are just trying to get away with something. There's a guy, Mark Gustavi, in the 80s. I couldn't stand that guy. And now he's nothing. He kind of just disappeared. Because his work was about the market and how he could manipulate the market and get away with it. And in some ways, Andy Warhol was about that. But his work was very deep, if you study him a little bit. It was very personal. And
So the market kind of self-corrects that?
The market is now... Every time somebody says something, like I hear myself say what you're saying in conversations with other artists, and it always makes you feel like an old person, right? Because it's like old people are always like, oh, those people are like, you know, like the next generation is messing up the world, you know? And so I look at it and I'm like, yeah, I feel kind of hopeless when I look at the art market. It's so ridiculous. It has no connection to the value of anything anymore, you know? And yet, people are still making art. You know, my friend who graduated from UCLA in a postmodern time where everything's conceptual thinks that I'm like so old school that I make paintings. And I'm like anybody that makes any art is old school because they're still making art. Like, if you have enough belief to make art, then you're believing in something that really makes no sense. It's almost like faith. Right? And so, you know, I would tell him that, like, if you continue, Marcel Duchamp, who I told you made The Fountain, that men's urinal, one of the things he's most famous for is that he stopped making art after only like 10 years of production, because he was like, I'm being a hypocrite if I keep making art, because all my art is about how absurd art making is. So I'm going to stop making art and just play chess the rest of my life, and he did. Because it was, you know, he knew that what he was saying was valid and cool and smart, but also that he was he was fooling, he was being a hypocrite, and like he was being like what you were saying, like just trying to make something off of it, off of the idea at that point. So he did have like, they convinced him like 20 years later to come back and have one exhibition, and he put all his work all over the walls, but then he had like, he took string and made like spider webs across the entire gallery in every direction so he could barely walk through it, and then he had little children playing ball the entire time. So he made it as hard as possible for people to like see it because he wanted to like still be funny, you know, still be smart and funny at the same time. Question?
So could you do a painting and then you sell the painting but you keep the rights to the NFT?
I think you could, yeah, sure. Sure. You can also, there's also issues about like when an artist makes a painting, you can buy it, but there's certain rights that you never own as the owner that still belong to the artist. Like you can't change it. You can't alter it. That's illegal. Like, isn't that right?
Yep.
And you can't destroy
it. Oh, without the artist's permission.
Yeah.
Even when you're copying it, like if you want to reprint it or a poster, it's so, not in any way.
But even that thing, like it would be interesting to do like a paper about the evolution of those laws. Like what copyright matters and what rights still belong to the artist. You know, because if I was really mad at an artist, I would buy their work and destroy it. It'd be worth the money just to like, right? Or something like that. Who knows? So, anything else? Okay. Oh, that was just a stunt, though, I think. Sorry, Banksy is a street artist who mostly does stencil paintings on walls, and he never signs them, and he never gets caught doing them because it's graffiti, it's illegal, but he's built up a reputation over time, so that now if he does one on a wall, people will, like, buy the building, cut around it, and take that thing because now it's worth like $500,000 and the building's only worth like $100,000. And so he hates that. So he tries to like sue them or he tries to like deny that it's his or something like that. So he did this one piece where he sold this drawing, but it had a built-in shredder in the frame.
Oh, yeah.
And so once they took it off the wall at auction, like sold for, you know, $700,000 to this person. As soon as they take it off the wall, it activates the machine and it shreds the picture. Except that it got jammed.
What?
About two-thirds of the way through, it got jammed. So the top third of the picture was still there. The rest was just dangling like little feathers. And it's like, oh, I wonder if he knew that it was going to get jammed at that point. So he could still sell it for this money and not get sued, but yet still, you know, be in the news all over the world for shredding his own work. What a guy, Banksy. You know what I mean? So there's like, there's definitely a lot of marketing, but there's some shrewdness too, right? It's very clever. That he knew for sure how that was going to get a big response. Question?
I was going to say, even if it had completely shredded, those pieces were still the art.
Yep, yeah, that's right. That's
oh,
right.
The value of it like went through the roof when he did it.
Yeah.
You know, I saw this article where these two teenagers were in the MoMA, I think, in New York, and they took off, one of them took off their glasses and put it like just a foot away from the wall. And everybody's coming around, and they're looking around for the text, of course. They don't see the text, and they take pictures of it.
Oh my.
And they take a selfie with it. It was great. And the museum people thought it was the best thing in the world, you know, because it was like, it wasn't touching their collection, but it was bringing a conversation that is, if something's in a museum, and now little objects suddenly have the ability to become art, can I do that with anything? You know, so that's like that was very smart.
Did the kid get arrested when he picked up his glasses?
Oh, right, that's right. I'm sorry that I keep going and going, but I do have a story about that I love. That same artist who took all the photos of the office workers for 1 hour, she went to this small museum, I think in Western Massachusetts, and it's a very small museum, but it had like a couple of great works of art, and one of their works of art was a Egyptian mummy in a case. So the Egyptian mummy is in a big glass case in the middle of this room. And this museum only has like four workers, like the director of the museum, the person who cleans up at the end of the night, the guy who's in the restoring, keeping up the collection. So the guy who cleans every night takes Windex and washes that glass box every night because there's always nose prints and fingerprints, okay? At one point, she comes in, Merle Latterman Ukelis comes in, and she goes, I want to document you cleaning that case as a work of performance art. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, okay. And the restoration guy's like, okay. So they all stand there smiling for the camera because they know how funny this is going to be. Because the second that she documented him cleaning, he was never allowed to clean it again because now it was a work of art. And it was the other guy's job to clean it. The museum curator, restorer, and the custodian was like, this is great. I never have to wash that thing again. I can go home an hour early every day. You know, and so they all just got a huge, when you look at the picture of the three of them, they all look like they just got away with like some great joke. They all had like that little grimace, that little like mischievous look in their eye. I love it. I love that artist.
And that's a commentary on who gets seen in the museum. So women and the janitors are the ones that are invisible, and so she made them visible.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job. Great question.